I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're thinking about it, chances are we're talking about it on WHYY's Radio Times.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
Consensus about the reality of global warming. Even some skeptics, including President Bush, have acknowledged that human beings are contributing to climate change. My guests Ted Nordhaus and Michael Schellenberger are the authors of a new book called Breakthrough, From the Death of Environmentalism to the Politics of Possibility. It's based in part on a much-debated article they wrote in 2004. Among the many things they say in this book is that there has to be a new kind of politics to reduce the threats of global warming. The policies that help to reduce smog and acid rain, they say, won't work for climate change. They also criticize the current environmental movement for focusing too much on limits and on sacrifice. They say that innovation and investment will help address the environmental challenges of the 21st century. Well, they join us here in our Philadelphia studios, and let me officially introduce them to you. Michael Schellenberger is a longtime environmental strategist, president of the Breakthrough Institute, that's a public policy think tank, and co-founder of American Environics, and that's a research and strategy firm. Michael Schellenberger, nice to have you with us. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
And Ted Nordhaus is chairman of Breakthrough Institute and co-founder of American Environics, and nice to have you with us as well. Good morning, Ted.
Thanks for having me.
Let me begin with you, if I could, Ted Nordhaus. Why does global warming require a new set of environmental policies?
Well, this is really one of the central arguments in our book, which is that the what we call the pollution paradigm, which is really the sort of operational sort of mental model for how the modern environmental movement has thought about environmental problems and what you need to do to solve them, really is terribly ill-suited to the challenges that we're faced with today to address the climate crisis. That reducing pollution by putting scrubbers on smokestacks, relatively small number of smokestacks, catalytic converters on automobiles, worked pretty well to deal with things like local air pollution, local water pollution. But the challenge associated with global warming is to really remake the entire global energy economy. And this is a challenge that is not going to be centrally about limiting or restricting pollution. It's going to be about building and creating and innovating and inventing an entirely new energy economy. So it's a very different kind of challenge.
And I want to get to that economy. Let me turn to you, if I could, Michael Schellenberger. Would you say, though, that the environmental movement, in broad terms, deserves some success for dealing with the problems of clean air, clean water, smog, pollution, that kind of thing?
Well, they definitely deserve a lot of credit for that. And as Ted just mentioned, you know, that politics of limits did a very good job dealing with smog in Los Angeles and acid rain, but it hasn't been up to the challenge of dealing with global warming. I mean, this isn't just a policy problem. This is a problem of an overall worldview, an overall framework. And, you know, as environmentalism has struggled of late to deal with issues like climate change, what we've seen is an increasing effort by environmentalists to just emphasize how terrifying global warming is. So one of the arguments of the book, too, is that we need a positive politics that is very large, very expansive, and that really redefines what gets counted and what doesn't get counted as the environment.
You do both criticize the, again, environmental movement in its broad terms, saying that they focus too much on limits, too much on sacrifice, have a kind of nostalgia, I guess, for a certain kind of world view. Are they that out of step with what's going on, Michael?
Well, it's interesting. You know, in the essay, one of the most famous lines from it, the line that got quoted the
most
was...
This was the essay of a couple of years ago.
Yeah, we wrote it just before the 2004 elections. We said, you know, Martin Luther King didn't give the I Have a Nightmare speech. And, you know, he gave an I Have a Dream speech. And the argument was we need a positive vision of the future that people can get excited about. But the interesting thing was, you know, when in writing the book, we decided we wanted to start with the March on Washington speech that King gave. And what we discovered is that, in fact, you know, he was so angry because, you know, President Kennedy had asked him to call off the march. He gave a very despairing, very dark speech. It was sort of an I Have a Nightmare speech indeed. And then the great gospel singer, Mahalia Jackson, who was just sitting behind King on the dais, and she'd been traveling around with King and heard him practicing the dream speech, and she just yells out, you know, tell him about the dream, Martin. Mm. And he kind of gets a little flustered and kind of searching for his words, and then she just yells it again, tell him about the dream. And with that, he to himself, he said, you know, but we should not wallow in the valley of despair. And from that moment forward, goes and gives the I Have a Dream speech, and it became, you know, of course, one of the greatest speeches ever given.
Well, let me turn to you, Ted, because one of the arguments you hear from the quote-unquote traditional environmental movement today is that the American way of life is really unsustainable. The way we live uses up a lot of the world's natural resources, and if everyone in the world lived like us, there wouldn't be a lot of natural resources left. Are you saying there's something wrong with that argument?
Well, what we're really saying is that, sure, it's a good thing for Americans to move towards a more what we call post-material way of being in the world. And we make an important distinction between what we call post-materialism and anti-materialism, in that we think it's important to recognize that there are some pretty basic material preconditions to starting to be concerned about the environment in the way that environmentalists in developed societies like ours are. But that said, sacrificing, limiting our energy, you know, using energy more efficiently, not consuming as much stuff is not going to get us where we need to go in terms of the global climate crisis. China, 2 billion Chinese and Indians are just tasting the first fruits of prosperity and modernity. No matter what we tell them, they are going to go through the same process as we did of development and of materialism. So if we want to stabilize the climate, mm-hmm. we had darn well better find a way for them to meet their energy needs, and those energy needs are going to expand exponentially in the next century in a way that doesn't pollute the atmosphere and increase temperatures globally.
But does that mean and that recycling, I mean, some of the basic things that people who care about the environment do, that's really not an effective strategy to deal with the environmental challenges?
Recycling is great, and there are lots and lots of really good reasons to recycle. But if you think you're going to deal with the climate crisis and global warming by recycling and screwing in a few new light bulbs, it's not going to do it, and we should stop telling people that it is.
To you, Michael, then, looking at some of this strategy for the future, how do you then create, I guess, enough consensus in the world to deal with the challenges of global warming? And you've got developed
right.
countries, you've got developing countries, you've got countries at war.
Right, this is the issue. I mean, 2 weeks ago, the United Nations met in New York, and everybody left after trying to negotiate on global warming, really discouraged, saying, boy, it's just too bad because people keep putting economic development ahead of global warming. And we kind of would laugh and go, well, the whole way to deal with global warming is through a kind of economic development. Now, the challenge, of course, is that China's got a lot of very cheap coal. They just have to dig it up and burn it. But the good news is that one quarter of all solar panels are manufactured in China.
Is that right?
And so China is going to dominate solar manufacturing, for the foreseeable future. So they also have an interest in accelerating our transition to a clean energy economy. So, you know, one of the themes in the book is the model for dealing with global warming comes not from dealing with acid rain or smog. It actually comes from major global economic development initiatives like the Marshall Plan, which rebuilt Europe.
And the idea is huge amounts of investment in some of these new technologies, like solar, for instance?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the paradox, the funny thing is that environmental groups are so focused on increasing the cost of dirty energy so that clean energy becomes cost competitive. Mm-hmm. Our point is that you can reduce the price of clean energy directly through technological innovation. Now, that technology innovation is not happening by private firms now. They can't make these big, risky, long-term investments. So the key is for governments, the United States and Europe, really the wealthiest governments in the world, to make these shared investments to bring down the price of technologies like solar.
Let me turn to you, though, Ted, because I think the model that we have, that we operate out of today, which is that growth comes from burning more fossil fuels. I mean, in many ways, that's the way our economy is structured.
Well, that's right, and that is what we argue is the fundamental challenge that we're faced with in this next century, and that we need to deal with as quickly as possible, which is to sever or decouple the relationship between energy use and energy consumption and pollution. That's all that matters in the end, is how quickly can we innovate, invent, and deploy clean energy technologies that are cost competitive with things like coal that pollute a lot, not only here in the U.S., but in places like China and India.
But looking at Congress, you know, which is where a lot of this legislation has to come from, do you see anything or anyone in Congress that wants to address this? Because, again, we talk about CAFE standards and things like that. It's all about oil and the automobile.
Well, it's interesting. You know, the Democratic presidential candidates are actually well in front of the national environmental movement right now. Barack Obama just came out and announced a $150 billion clean energy investment program just this week. Hillary Clinton has proposed $50 billion. John Edwards has proposed $13 billion annually. And there's a little bit of an arms race going on between the Democratic presidential candidates right now in terms of who can propose the biggest clean energy investment. So we're very encouraged by that. What we're sort of still lacking in Congress is committed clean energy technology lobby. The environmental movement has been so sort of single-mindedly obsessed with regulatory solutions and capping carbon emissions that they really aren't terribly committed to. On paper, they'll tell you, oh yeah, we support clean energy investment, but when you actually look what they're doing and not what they're saying, where their resources is going, where their energy is going, the kinds of legislation that's being proposed in the Congress right now, it's all focused on limits and regulation. There's very little that the environmental movement has really prioritized in terms of actually making these big public investments that we need to make.
And we're about a minute away from our first break, but to you, Michael, do you find there's a groundswell, though, in the public? I mean, these lobbyists, such as they are, you know, come from public interest in a particular kind of issue.
Absolutely.
Is the public here?
Oh, the public has been way ahead of environmental groups on this as well for the last 10 years. I mean, Gallup just did a survey last April, and they found that 65% of Americans supported spending at least $30 billion a year to bring down the price of clean energy and to really take a global leadership in these very fast-growing markets of the future.
But at the same time, people go nuts, you know, if the cost of gasoline goes over $3 a gallon.
Well, and understandably. I mean, I think that that's why the goal isn't to make dirty energy expensive so much as it is to make clean energy cheap. And there is a good way to do it, but it does require shared investment. And that's why the focus has to be on these major public investments.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. And that's Michael Schellenberger, also with us, Ted Nordhaus. They're co-authors of a new book. It's called Breakthrough, From the Death of Environmentalism to the Politics of Possibility. And join us today on Radio Time to talk about some of the interesting ideas in this book. And we're opening up the phones for your questions and comments. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY Focus Features, presenting the new espionage film Lust, Caution, from Ang Lee, the Academy Award-winning director of Brokeback Mountain. Lust, Caution, now in select theaters.
The National Constitution Center proudly supports WHYY. They're partners and style makers, confidants and social activists. They're our nation's first ladies. And now the National Constitution Center provides an up-close look at details, public and private, in a new exhibit. First Ladies, Political Role and Public Image at the National Constitution Center, October 5th through December 31st. Information is available online at www.constitutioncenter.org.
Have you ever wanted to question the guests on Radio Times in person instead of on the phone? Well, here's your chance. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, inviting you to join us for a Radio Time special taped at Princeton University on Wednesday, October 24th at 6 p.m. This event is free for all WHYY members. Reserve your seat by calling 215-351-0511 or visit whyy.org. See you in Princeton on October 24th.
Mind Body Spirit Expo supports WHYY with Deepak Chopra, Marianne Williamson, and Brian Weiss at Valley Forge Convention Center, October 26th to 28th. Details at mindbodyspiritexpo.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain. And if you're just joining us, talking today with Ted Nordhaus and Michael Schellenberger, co-authors of a new book called Breakthrough, From the Death of Environmentalism to the Politics of Possibility. And they are co-founders of American Environics, a research and strategy firm, and also involved with a think tank called the Breakthrough Institute. Michael is the president and Ted is the chairman. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Michael, let me go back to you and talk a bit about Kyoto. In this book, you both write about the failures of Kyoto to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
Well, we open the book by talking about there's a set of inconvenient truths that we that care about global warming have to deal with, one of which is that the countries that ratified Kyoto saw their overall greenhouse gas emissions go up by 4%, not down, between 2000 and 2004. And in fact, the countries that did see their emissions go down, such as Britain and Germany, well, they went down for reasons that had nothing to do with the environment or global warming. Margaret Thatcher broke the coal miners' union, Germany reunified, and they took offline a bunch of coal-fired power plants. So the problem with Kyoto is that it really pits economic development against action on global warming, whereas those two things have to be one and the same. And that's, again, why the focus is so much on global international investment.
Has there ever been a treaty that married those two ideas?
Absolutely. And one of the great example of this is really the rebuilding of the European countries after World War II.
The Marshall Plan.
But of course, European nations were involved. Churchill actually proposed it after he was voted out of office in 1946. And what was amazing about it is that it was actually called the European Coal and Steel Community before it was known as the EU. And it actually was a big investment in energy. In that case, it was coal. But, the thing that economists tell you is that energy has a multiplier effect on the whole economy. So investments in energy and in advancing energy technologies are huge drivers of economic growth.
Let me talk to you, Ted, and then we'll get to our callers. You, again, write about something in the book called Insecure Affluence as a kind of attitude that Americans have, and perhaps colors even their view of the environment, and perhaps even the view of the policies that you're talking about.
Well, that's right, and one of the things that we point out in the book is that the sort of great accomplishments of the modern environmental movement happen virtually at the moment of its birth. They happen in the early 70s with the passage of the Clean Air and Clean Water Acts and a raft of other environmental legislation by the U.S. Congress. And you kind of go, well, at that point you have this sort of movement in its sort of embryonic state. I mean, we do not have these big environmental NGOs like we do today, yet they get much more far-reaching legislation and policies passed then than they're able to do now.
So with a Republican president.
With a Republican president. So what's going on here? And what we argue is that this particular post-war moment, and really there's about two decades after World War II, extraordinary affluence, extraordinary prosperity. And here is when we see the great accomplishments, not only of modern environmentalism, but the civil rights movement, the women's movement. If you go through all of the liberal social movements of the 20th century, this is sort of this watershed moment for all of them. And we argue that that's because there's some underlying things going on in terms of American values and how Americans are living in the world. They're secure, they're prosperous, they're optimistic. Well, what happens in the next 30 years is that Americans really start losing ground in all kinds of ways. And even as they're becoming more affluent in purely material terms, they're becoming insecure in a whole set of other ways as the post-industrial economy, globalization, a whole set of other economic forces and social forces lead Americans to feel a lot less insecure. And we go and cite a whole lot of psychological research that shows that when people become fearful, when they become insecure, they become more conservative. So we make the case that environmentalists cannot simply keep themselves in this box of caring about ecological problems, that in terms of the social safety net and building a post-industrial social safety net, there's a whole set of things that we have to do that cannot be defined conventionally as environmentalism that are necessary preconditions for motivating Americans to support the kinds of actions on the environment and global warming that we want them to take.
You have a lot of criticisms for the progressive environmental movement, and I frankly think some of it is either unfair or doesn't really get to, I think, some pretty vigorous debate within the environmental movement. The debate over nuclear power, for instance. I mean, you see traditional environmentalists arguing with each other about the usefulness of nuclear energy within, you know, a larger need for energy in this country. You talk about Robert F. Kennedy, well-known environmentalist who opposes the windmill farm in Nantucket Sound off the Kennedy compound. But there are many environmentalists in this country who believe that wind has an important role to play. Can you speak to that?
Absolutely. And again,
and this
you
is,
know, we,
Michael.
Yeah, and you know, we came out of the environmental and progressive movements. We worked in our whole lives, and frankly, our experience was that there really wasn't any room for debate. In fact, we released the essay in 2004 at a conference of environmental grant makers, which was just scandalous.
Yes,
you know?
It was. This and, was 2004.
Yeah, and
yes.
People would say, "But you, why did you have to release it there?" And it was kind of like, "Well, where else would we release it? I mean, there's no other forum for that kind of debate. I mean, literally, the American Librarians Association has much more vigorous debates about the future of archival standards than environmentalists have about strategy." So,
but do you think that's true today? I mean, this
I
is
still
only a couple
think it's
years
true,
later.
And I'll tell you something else. I mean, like on nuclear, there really isn't debate within the environmental movement. The people that have been calling for nuclear are actually not the mainstream environmental groups. They're pretty still wedded to an anti-nuclear position. Now, in terms of wind, what we point out in the book is that the country's most famous environmentalist is arguably Robert F. Kennedy Jr. I mean, maybe it's Al Gore as well, but really one of the most best known.
Sure.
And he literally goes and crusades against the wind farm, which would be visible from the Kennedy compound in Hyannisport. And our point is that, you know, that this is not just the problem of one loose cannon of environmental leaders. This is a problem that's relating back to this larger sense in which people who live close to particular areas have a special say over how they will be used. And so, and this is, we point out that these are called Not in My Backyard campaigns or NIMBY campaigns. Then the environmental movement has long valorized NIMBY campaigns as sort of a crucial element to protecting nature. And in fact, here we have this paradox where the NIMBY campaign in Hyannisport actually threatens the larger global ecosystem.
But at the same time, would you agree that there is some good either debate or even positive interest within the environmental movement for wind power and for windmills and turbines and all of that?
Absolutely. But the challenge, again, is that you have the national environmental organizations, which did, to their credit, and we acknowledge this very strongly in the book, support the wind farm in Cape Cod. Mm-hmm. But you also have national environmental leaders like Robert Kennedy Jr. and also a whole set of local groups who oppose development, and they oppose development in the name of nature. And so you've got a problem there, which is that, you know, who really gets to speak for nature? And is that really the way we're going to be able to figure out how to develop our world? Is it going to be by who speaks for nature, who doesn't? Or is it really, what kind of a nature do we want? What kind of a development do we want?
One of the arguments I've heard, yes, go ahead, Ted, that I've heard against the wind farms is that, birds get caught up in it, so that there is a negative effect on the environment. Go ahead, and then we will get to our callers.
You know, there's actually been a whole set of studies done on the bird issues that are just have demonstrated that modern windmills don't have that impact. But I think the larger issue, and the reason we chose to write about it in the book, is just because it points out the larger argument that we're making, which is that this ethic of nature protection, of preserving nature and protecting it from human intrusions, doesn't serve us very well when we have to actually go create new things. And the ways in which we see these conflicts coming up in places like Cape Cod around wind farms just suggests and points out the ways in which environmentalists and this ethic that underlies environmentalism just gets itself all tangled up and crossed up when it has to deal with the need to actually create new things and not just and good things, not just stop bad things.
But are you saying it's an anti-technology movement?
Well, there is certainly a strong anti-technology ethic that runs through environmentalism all the way back to Henry David Thoreau. Hmm. I mean, it is sort of, in some ways, sort of hardwired into the underlying philosophy. But beyond that, there's lots of environmentalists who, in particular settings, are pro-technology. And we acknowledge that and we support it. It's just that it's important to recognize that sometimes the mental models that we have and the philosophical underpinnings and conceptual underpinnings for our politics just get outmoded and don't serve the needs that we have today very well. And that's really our argument about the classical sort of environmental ethic, and that's what we argue needs to die.
Let me just reintroduce you both, and then we will get to our callers, and that's Ted Nordhaus. Also with us, Michael Schellenberger, co-authors of a new book. It's called Breakthrough, From the Death of Environmentalism to the Politics of Possibility. They are co-founders of American I'm never going to get this word out correctly.
Environics.
Thank you very much. Research and strategy firm. Also, Michael is president of the Breakthrough Institute, and Ted is the chairman of the Breakthrough Institute. And we've got a bunch of callers here. Let me get our first caller on the air who wants to remain anonymous. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you. The reason I wanted to remain anonymous is because I work for an environmental group, and I don't have permission to speak for them.
Oh, okay.
But I did want to comment on the point that your guest made earlier, that environmentalists are so focused on caps and on making dirty energy expensive, as he put it, that they forget that making clean energy cheaper would be a good thing to do, and maybe we should invest in that. And that's a fundamental misunderstanding of what environmentalists are trying to accomplish with the cap. And that is to spur innovation in the marketplace. The idea is that none of us have a crystal ball. None of us know which technology is going to be the winner. None of us know where the money should go. And having government make that decision is very inefficient. Having the market make the decision is the fastest and most efficient way to figure out where the clean technologies are that will win and where the money should go. So the cap isn't about making dirty energy expensive. It's about creating an environment where innovation can happen, so these clean technologies can be created in the way that they can be created most efficiently.
Okay.
And just a small example.
Well, you know what? Just hold on 1 second, only because we had a lot of calls, and your point is a good one. And
right.
I know Michael Schellenberger wants to respond.
Yes,
go ahead, Michael. Thanks.
The cap would make dirty energy more expensive. That is the effect of it, whether or not we want to say that, whether or not people, environmental groups, want to say that publicly or not. That is the effect of it. And it's interesting, the caller really recites something that is a kind of market fundamentalism. It's this idea that the government should not pick winners and losers, that if you just set this cap, that all, you know, the new technologies will emerge on their own. Well, it's interesting to note that really, you know, we did an extensive review of the energy science literature, and we just didn't find that to be anything that any of the experts were saying. In fact, they would say that we're always picking winners and losers when it comes to the energy markets. We've been picking coal and oil for the last 100 years, and in fact, the federal government always makes strategic investments in technologies, and a lot of them don't work, and that's fine, but a lot of them do work. So we point out that in the late 50s, the U.S. government decided that microchips were a strategic thing for the national security. So the price started at $1,000. The U.S. government literally bought a huge number of microchips. Price came down to about $20 each. That's a great model, silicon-based microchips, great model for silicon-based solar panels. Every time we double production, the price comes down 20%. That's definitely solar is definitely a winner that we should be picking. So it's just, we do agree that there does need to be a cap on greenhouse gas emissions, but that will only get us to about 20 to 30% of where we need to go. To get to away from a coal and oil-based economy, we have to make strategic investments in clean energy technologies directly.
And thanks for the call. And to Ted, do you, though, agree in any way with our caller who says that caps do spur innovation? I mean, when there's a challenge to industry, they have to come up with some kind of a solution. Someone has to figure out how to solve this problem.
Well, what we point out is that what caps are going to do is they're going to drive private investment into getting the sort of lowest hanging fruit available. It's going to be burning methane from landfills. It's going to be good, important investments in things like energy efficiency. What it's not going to do is make the long-term investments, not only in doing research and development, but in doing what's called early-stage deployment of really disruptive energy technologies like PV solar. Moreover, it's not going to make the other investments that you need to make to bring those technologies online, radical improvements in energy storage and battery storage, and really rebuilding the entire electrical grid at a cost of many billions of dollars, which is a common public investment that the private sector just is not going to make. So for all of those reasons, yes, a cap is a good thing, but it is not the silver bullet that environmentalists have suggested that it is. And we are going to need to make big, big long-term public investments to get where we need to go in terms of carbon reductions.
Thanks for the call. And we've got Randy now from Medford joining us. Hi, Randy. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Yes, there he is. Go ahead, Randy.
Excellent program.
Thank you.
I just want to say it seems to me, I'm pulling over off of the turnpike here now,
okay.
So I apologize.
That's okay. Go ahead.
But a real problem is that the investment community has been down this road before. Back in the late 70s and early 80s, a lot of money was poured into alternative energy only to find it all blow away, and everybody standing around wondering what happened when the Saudis started losing or worried about market share, and they can open the spigots at any time, and we'll be more than happy to take the cheap oil because we're addicted to it. So and unless you have some sort of protection there, everybody's just afraid that can happen again, and it will happen again.
Well, Randy, I appreciate the call. It kind of, a David Goliath situation that he's referring to. I'm back to you, Michael.
Yeah, so what happened was, the caller is right, that private firms can't be expected to make large long-term investments in very early-stage technologies. These are investments that have to be made by the federal government, and preferably by the United States and Europe together. Now, it's interesting to note that there have been major advances in the last 30 years, I mean, or even the last 20 years in terms of the price of solar. You know, as Ted mentioned, the windmills we have now are these massive devices where the blades move so slowly that literally birds kind of have to run into them rather than the older kind of rotor blades that they had in the 70s. And so there's been some huge advances, but the caller is right that the private sector can't be expected to make these investments on their own. They're really, really in front of what we find is that private investments actually follow public investments in the energy sector.
But at the same time, and you talk about the role of Congress and the value of lobbyists. I mean, you know, the oil, talk about David and Goliath, the oil lobby in Congress is humongous, Ted.
Well, you know, some folks who have sort of attacked our argument kind of go, well, no, look at the ethanol subsidies, look at the coal subsidies. You can't count on the government to do anything. And we point out that, you know, first of all, regulatory strategies are as vulnerable to those lobbies kind of getting in there and messing them up as is public investment. And that given the fact that we have seen public investments kind of go wrong in the past, that's all the more reason to have a serious public technology and public investment strategy. You know, literally, the environmental movement has done very little thinking about how you might insulate clean energy investment from the congressional pork barrel process. You know, and that's going to be as require as vigorous a fight and as long-term a fight as establishing and defending regulations is. And where the environmental movement has been very good and knows how to fight for regulations, really doesn't know a whole lot about how you go get public investment, how you fight for it, how you keep it, and how you keep it from getting hijacked.
Another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Ted Nordhaus, also with us, Michael Schellenberger, and we are talking about their new book. It's called Breakthrough, From the Death of Environmentalism to the Politics of Possibility. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Penn Presents supports WHYY and welcomes Celtic Renaissance musicians Anunya and acclaimed all-female Irish band Cherish the Ladies for back-to-back performances at the Annenberg Center for the Arts, October 12th and 13th. The Irish Roots Music Festival featuring Anunya and Cherish the Ladies, October 12th and 13th, with special packages available. For information, 215-898-3900 or online at pennpresents.org.
On October 25th, WHYY's The Next Mayor Project hosts a candidate forum. It's your chance to pose questions to the hopefuls, but we'd like you to do it in video form. Email your video or a clever computer-generated character asking about your most important issue. Be creative and make it personal. Then log on to the forum on October 25th as we put those questions to the candidates. For more details, visit whyy.org.
The University of Pennsylvania Health System supports WHYY. Penn has a team of cancer specialists at the Abramson Cancer Center comprised of surgeons, therapists, and researchers. They are all dedicated to advancing the diagnosis, treatment, and prevention of cancer and creating surgical techniques to help treat it. More information about the Abramson Cancer Center at the University of Pennsylvania Health System can be found online at www.pennhealth.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. 3 years ago, Ted Nordhaus and Michael Schellenberger wrote an essay called The Death of Environmentalism, which generated a lot of controversy and debate. They said the policies to deal with acid rain and smog won't work for global warming. They also said the environmental movement had stagnated. Now they've expanded on that idea. They've written a new book, and it's titled Breakthrough from the Death of Environmentalism to the Politics of Possibility. Let me get Peter from Morrisville to join us. Hi, Peter. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Hi, I really love your program.
Thank you.
And I'd like to put out my question, and then I'll take my answer offline.
Sounds good to me. Go ahead.
Okay, great. I'm a mechanical engineer, so I'm a real – I love technology. And so I'm all for photovoltaic, solar thermal, because like 100 square miles of that could take care of all the energy needs of America right now. But my question is, what do they think about nuclear? Because nuclear is has been redesigned. The newer nuclear design reactors are extremely safe. Thank you very much. I'll take it offline.
Thanks, Peter, for the call, and back to you, Michael.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, we did this pretty comprehensive review of the energy sciences and energy economics literature, and we literally could not find a serious energy expert who said that we should not use nuclear. I mean,
really?
Nuclear provides about 20% of America's electricity, and if we're trying to get to 80% reductions by 2050, it would make things a lot harder if we took all of that nuclear offline. But it's interesting.
Would it be easier if we put more online?
Well,
it would.
I mean, nuclear is obviously, you know, essentially either low or very or zero carbon emissions. So,
right.
So obviously it would have a big impact. You've got huge challenges, obviously, in terms of the security of the plants
and the
safety and the waste. But, you know, I think it's fair to say that Ted and I are far more alarmed by the seriousness of global warming than we are about the safety of plants. And, you know, I would just say that, you know, point out that in 2005, the federal government put, you know, in the energy bill, the Bush energy bill, the federal government basically put such huge investments into nuclear that they effectively are buying down the price of nuclear. And our point is that if you really hate nuclear, then you ought to advocate a similarly large investment into the really good stuff, like solar and wind and other technologies.
But do you end up, if you go nuclear or more nuclear, do you solve one problem but create another, which is what you do with all the byproduct?
Well, yeah, and similarly, I think we are the last guy's going to come out and say, hey, nukes is the answer. And as Michael pointed out, if we don't want nukes to be the answer, we had better start making big investments in bringing solar and wind and other alternatives to scale. That said, if you really go take a hard look at the issues associated with storage of nuclear waste, we're talking about 10,000 and 100,000 and million year sort of time scales that people are worried about in terms of contamination and its effect. With global warming, we're talking about potentially, you know, radical climate change happening in the scale of a couple hundred years. If you have to sort of balance kind of risks, I think you would do what you had to do to deal with the climate problem, and we'll figure out with the what to do with the storage problems down the line. Again, I think that there are other alternatives, but if we are serious about those other alternatives, we'd better start making the investments now to bring them to scale.
And if we were to make the investments now on the scale that you were looking for, could we stop global warming? Would we slow the effects? I mean, you know, so much is already in process,
speak.
Michael,
well, and it's actually, I mean, this is our big point in the book, too, is that environmentalists have long wanted to emphasize scientific certainty. But in fact, there's reason to act in the face of uncertainty. And it's now turning out that, in fact, you know, the ice in the Arctic is melting it's melting and moving a lot faster than scientists had thought it would. And so there's very good reasons to take action now. But you know, the other thing we write about in the book is that we also have to prepare for global warming. It's happening. It's not going away. You know, there's a delay between how much emissions you put in the atmosphere and the temperature increases mm-hmm. that you get. And so, you know, for years, environmental groups have opposed talk of adaptation and global warming preparedness because they feared that, well, that would be sort of accommodating ourselves or giving up. And it's just outrageous. I mean, I think to the credit of the environmental community, you know, we wrote an op-ed piece after Hurricane Katrina struck arguing that, look, whether or not you believe Hurricane Katrina was made more serious by warmer ocean waters in the Gulf of Mexico or not, there's good reason to have a global warming preparedness agenda. Mm. 1 week later, Carl Pope from the Sierra Club endorsed that call. We now see the Stern Review, the United Nations, all embracing a strategy around adaptation and preparedness. What we haven't yet seen is the environmental lobby really putting its muscle behind that kind of agenda.
And when you talk about the environmental lobby, who are you talking about?
Well, we're talking about the large groups in Washington that determine the agenda. In other words, there's a lot of grassroots organizations in the country that are doing great work, but in terms of like what is the legislation that gets introduced, how are the budgets spent for advertising and media and lobbying spent, those are the really big groups.
And then who are we talking about?
You know, it's NRDC, it's
Natural Resources Defense Council.
It's Environmental Defense, it's the Sierra Club, you know, and it's the major environmental foundations.
Let me get back to our callers. We've got Liz from West Philadelphia. Hi, Liz, go ahead, your Radio Times.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was calling in reference to all the different ways that we need to make investments in new energy, and I'm wondering about what the guests think that if taking away all the subsidies for oil and gas. I mean, that seems like a great source for money, and in other places, like in Europe, they're not subsidized so much, and we are addicted, and that would probably be one way to make us less addicted, and then there's a source for money for investment.
Ted, go ahead. What do you think?
Absolutely. Subsidies are a good source. So is when and if we get a carbon regulatory scheme in place, there is a lot of potential revenue from that. So there's lots of opportunities to define a revenue stream. And again, that can come from current subsidies. It can come from regulation of carbon. The challenge is to get serious about actually defining what that public investment strategy is, mm-hmm. how much money we need, where it needs to go, how we're going to make sure it gets spent on the things it needs to get spent on. And then take that fight as seriously as we take the regulatory battles. And this is just a critical shift that those of us who care about climate change have got to make, because the investment is every bit as important as the regulation.
You criticize the environmental movement. What do you say about their opponents? I mean, what is the environmental movement up against from your perspective, Ted?
Well, obviously, you have a huge, fossil fuel industry that has spent a lot of money over the years to lobby Congress, to get their message out, and that is formidable. Now, recognizing that, it's all the more reason to kind of put our best political foot forward. And we also make the case when you look at opinion research, which I come out of that field, mm-hmm. is that investment in clean energy and making clean energy sources cheaper is the single most powerful message and concept that we have in the fight to advance these technologies and to advance the clean energy economy. So we ought to be basically putting that in the front. It can carry the regulatory agenda as long as what we're telling Americans is that this is really about making the investments in our future that we need to make so that we can all live the kind of lives we want to live.
But are you saying that that's an idea that the majority of people can sign on to?
Absolutely. And we see huge majorities of Americans supporting this agenda, among other things, because we stopped just talking about global warming, which, even after Inconvenient Truth, remains a pretty low priority for most American voters. And we get to start talking about much higher priority concerns, things like getting off oil, energy independence, creating jobs, and growing the economy in these new industries of the future, clean energy technologies.
Let me get Dawn from Doylestown to join us. Liz, thanks for the call. Dawn, go ahead. You're in Radio Times.
Hi. I wanted to make a couple comments. And first of all, I always wondered why we don't ramp up factory towns in all the Rust Belt, you know, Cincinnati, Allentown, Lancaster, and all of Ohio to become areas that create clean energy products. You know, especially versus casinos, that seems to be that's what's getting ramped up.
And don't get me started, Dawn. Yeah, go ahead.
That, and it doesn't seem like the political interaction is working towards something that is this incredibly important. And I also wanted to make the question about institutes and think tanks that have been working so hard against any kind of environmental change and creation of jobs. And that's like one of them is the CEI that I've read about in Washington. So I just wanted to ask and create discussion around those two things. Thank you.
I appreciate the call. Dawn, I'm back to you. Ted, you want to take the first one about factory towns?
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. When we started the Apollo Energy Project, which really was the beginning of this whole sort of journey that we've taken, it was the basis of writing our essay because we got so frustrated that the national environmental groups didn't see the opportunity that was in this agenda. But when we were trying to figure that out, we actually went to Erie, Pennsylvania, a dying industrial town, and did focus groups with local voters. And, you know, it was stunning. As we talked to these folks about this, we watched how excited they got about the opportunity that Erie might become a center for building windmills and wind farms to capture wind off of Lake Erie. And they were so excited. And towards the end, just to sort of check with my colleagues in the back, I walked out of the room and we went into the back. And to just talk. And as we were talking, they were still talking in the room, and they started speculating about who might be doing these focus groups. And they started
thinking. You were eavesdropping.
Yeah, we were eavesdropping. Okay. And they started, they were thinking, they were like, gosh, I wonder if it's a big company that wants to come and build a new factory here. And there was so much sort of hope there. And of course, it was sort of sad because, of course, there was not a big company coming to build a new clean energy industry in Erie, Pennsylvania. And in fact, you know, to this day, what the environmental movement largely offers those folks in Erie is carbon caps and higher energy prices, rather than a vision for a future for themselves and their community that might inspire them to demand the kind of change that we need.
Let me throw out the word population. I mean, how much is just the fact that we've got this growing worldwide population going to contribute to global warming?
Well, I mean, the interesting thing, of course, is that ever since Malthus in the 19th century, people have been predicting that we're going to run out of food. And, of course, there's no 7 billion of us, or almost 7 billion of us. And you know, Americans are struggling with eating too much, not eating too little. So the predictions of sort of mass ecological collapse have sort of repeatedly not come true. You know, our point in the book is that, you know, is it so hard for us to imagine a world where 7 billion people are mostly living in cities which are more ecological, actually more sustainable, more efficient, where we preserve large amounts of the non-human world of nature for a variety of reasons. Is that really so hard for us to imagine? And of course, it depends on us pursuing a kind of economic development, investing in a kind of economic development that does not demand depletion of resources or polluting the atmosphere.
Let me get back to a caller. We've got John from Newtown joining us. Hi, John. Go ahead. Your Radio Times.
Yes. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine.
Good. Go ahead.
First thing is there's a lot of wind farms off the North Wales coast. If you want to see them, go to North Wales in England and the UK.
Okay. Fair enough.
The second thing that struck me about the investment in the 50s, it was mostly informal. It was a lot done by the military and a lot done by the old NAS and the old NASA, and it was mainly individual initiative who had access to resources, and of course it was the military in those days, and two, and three, I guess, as an engineer, you know, there's trade-offs for everything.
Mm-hmm.
There's no such thing as a free lunch, as they say.
Indeed, and obviously someone that grew up or was living in England at the time, a chance to live through some of that. Let me get Michael Schellenberger.
Well, the first thing,
respond.
Just
thanks,
really, really briefly, is that, you know, everybody says, oh, these wind farms are going to be so terrible and a blight on the landscape. And, of course, they've become tourist attractions in Europe. People love to see them. They're actually quite beautiful and incredible machines. But to the larger point, you know, the truth is that the United States has always made these strategic investments in new industries. I mean, think about it. We built the railroads after World War II. We built the interstate highway system. Silicon Valley would literally not exist as an economic powerhouse had the United States military not first invested in radio, you know, invested in microchips, and literally invented the precursor to the internet. And if Al Gore deserves credit for anything, we think he deserves more credit for helping to commercialize the internet and create this incredible economic boom around around internet businesses.
Much more to talk about. I'm watching the clock here. To you, Ted, though, you say that, and I don't know if it's just environmentalists, but maybe as a nation we're focused too much on deficit. And I mean, clearly, with the war in Iraq, where you know we're just hemorrhaging money out of this country. Isn't that a factor, though, in trying to figure out how to innovate and how to invest and where to invest?
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, you know, when we said we need to move from the nightmare to the dream, we didn't say ignore the nightmare, pretend like it's not there. No, take a hard look at the nightmare. King gave an I Have a Nightmare speech, but then you've got to go to the dream. You've got to give people some hope. You've got to give them a vision of the future that is every bit as large and expansive and inspiring as the challenges that we're faced with are terrifying and scary. So that, you know, and the war in Iraq, you know, is a huge problem, and how we get out of it is an enormous challenge. But I can tell you one thing, which is that I think that having been able to articulate a vision for America's role in the world, and one that goes beyond fighting the terrorist threat to an idea of building the conditions for shared global prosperity to deal with both our economic future and our ecological future, is going to be a lot more productive way to kind of move us out of the nightmare and towards the dream than getting Americans ever more frightened by terrorists and ever more despairing about being bogged down in this endless war in Iraq.
Very quickly, go ahead,
Michael. I mean, we also point out in the book that, you know, Americans by any historical or global standard are some of the wealthiest people in the world. We're living longer, bigger houses, bigger homes. We're a wealthy nation. And in fact, despite the huge, colossal disaster that Iraq is and the amount of money we've spent on it, we still have much greater assets than we did after World War II when we made these big investments in rebuilding Europe.
We will end on that note. Thank you both for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having us.
You're welcome. Ted Nordhaus, Michael Schellenberger, author of a new book. It's called Breakthrough, From the Death of Environmentalism to the Politics of Possibility, published by Houghton Mifflin. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia, your member-supported news and information station serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware.